Willkommen zu ManyPod, dem Podcast der Rosa-Luxemburg-Stiftung für die Gesellschaft der Vielen. Hier diskutieren wir mit Menschen aus solidarischen Bewegungen, Netzwerken, Initiativen und aus der Forschung zu aktuellen öffentlichen Debatten zu Migration, Antirassismus und dem Kampf gegen Antisemitismus. In der letzten Folge ging es mit den damaligen beiden Gästen bereits um Erinnerungskultur, konkret mit Ulf Arminde um das umkämpfte Mahnmal für die Opfer der terroristischen Nagelbombe des NSU auf der Kolbstraße in Köln und um die erinnerungspolitischen Audio-Walks der Aktivistin und Künstlerin Miriam Schickler, die zur deutschen Erinnerungspolitik bezüglich des Holocausts arbeitet und sich mit der Frage auseinandersetzt, wie diese sich wiederum auf das Er- oder Entinnern anderer Opfergruppen rassifizierter, gegenderter oder ableistischer Gewalt auswirkt. Heute greifen wir die Debatte auf und steigen noch tiefer in das Thema der Erinnerungskultur ein. Und ich freue mich sehr, dass wir heute die Möglichkeit haben, mit Michael Rothberg zu sprechen, der uns per Videokonferenz aus Los Angeles zugeschaltet ist. Hi Michael.
Hallo.
Das, was wir hier seit Jahren in der politischen Solidaritätsarbeit mit Betroffenen von Rassismus an Praktiken des Erinnerns gelingt, etwa in der Arbeit zum NSU-Komplex oder der unglaublichen Arbeit der Angehörigen und Freunde der Ermordeten in Hanau, scheint wie die Praxis zu sein von dem Konzept, das Michael Rothberg schon vor über 10 Jahren entwickelt und in dem Buch Multidirectional Memory publiziert hat. Nun wurde sein Buch unter dem Titel Multidirektionale Erinnerung Holocaust-Gedenken im Zeitalter der Dekolonisierung in deutschsprachiger Übersetzung veröffentlicht, übrigens mit Unterstützung der Rosa-Luxemburg-Stiftung. Das Gespräch dazu mit Michael werden wir gleich auf Englisch führen. Diese Folge des ManyPods zu der Herausforderung multidirektionalen Erinnerns in der postmigrantischen Gesellschaft haben wir als Doppelfolge produziert. Im nächsten ManyPod spinnen wir diesen Faden, im zweiten Teil nämlich weiter mit Hannah Peaceman von der Redaktion Yalta, Position zur jüdischen Gegenwart und Naomi Henkel-Gümbel, Überlebende des Anschlags von Halle an Yom Kippur 2019 und Fragen nach dem Potenzial von verwobenen Erinnern aus unterschiedlichen Perspektiven für die Stärkung solidarischer Politiken. Mein Name ist Massimo Perinelli und ich freue mich, dass ich für das heutige Gespräch Sina Arnold als Co-Host gewinnen konnte. Hallo Sina.
Hallo.
Ich möchte dich kurz vorstellen. Du bist wissenschaftliche Mitarbeiterin am Zentrum für Antisemitismusforschung an der TU hier in Berlin sowie am Forschungsinstitut Gesellschaftlicher Zusammenhalt. Du arbeitest unter anderem zu aktuellen Antisemitismus in Deutschland und in den USA und zur Erinnerungspolitik in der postmigrantischen Gesellschaft. Außerdem bist du seit über 20 Jahren aktivistisch unterwegs in sozialen Bewegungen gegen Antisemitismus und Rassismus. Und durch dich habe ich auch vor 5 Jahren auf einer Konferenz im Jüdischen Museum Berlin die Arbeit von Michael Rothberg kennengelernt, der dort die Keynote Multidirectional Memory, Entangled Narratives, Implicated Subjects hielt. Umso mehr freue ich mich, dass wir hier nun alle gemeinsam an einem, zumindest digitalen, Tisch sitzen.
Ja, hallo Massimo. Ich freue mich auch sehr, dass diese Kooperation geklappt hat und dass wir heute hier gemeinsam sprechen. Und ich möchte aber als allererstes erstmal unseren Gast vorstellen. Michael Rothberg, er ist Professor für englische und vergleichende Literaturwissenschaft und er ist Inhaber des 1939 Society Samuel Gotts Lehrstuhls für Holocaust-Studien an der University of California in Los Angeles. Er befasst sich schon lange mit dem Thema Erinnerung, speziell auch mit dem Gedenken an den Holocaust und er hat vor etwa 20 Jahren schon das Buch Traumatic Realism, The Demands of Holocaust Representation verfasst, in dem er sich mit Texten von Leuten wie Ruth Klüger, Philip Roth oder Art Spiegelman beschäftigt. Hi Michael, we're glad you're here.
Hallo, freut mich.
Ja, ich selber bin vor einigen Jahren über das Buch von Michael Rothberg gestolpert, um das es heute gehen soll. Ein Buch, das 2009 unter dem Titel Multidirectional Memory, Remembering the Holocaust in the Age of Decolonization erschien. Und was ich damals aus der politischen Arbeit kannte und eigentlich bis heute kenne, ist vor allem eine Trennung. Also es gibt jene, die gegen Antisemitismus aktiv sind und es gibt jene, die gegen Rassismus mobilisieren. Man begegnet sich höchstens mal auf Anti-Nazi-Demos, aber oft sind es doch getrennte Diskurse, getrennte Praktiken, getrennte Bewegungen. Und die spielen in der Gegenwart, aber sie hängen eben auch mit der Vergangenheit zusammen, also mit Erinnerungen an rassistische und antisemitische Gewalt. Und ich habe mich damals gefragt, ob das Buch vielleicht einen Ausweg aus solchen Konkurrenzverhältnissen bieten könnte. Das Buch, um das es geht, ist jetzt also endlich ins Deutsche übersetzt worden. Es ist im Februar im Metropol Verlag erschienen mit dem Titel Multidirektionale Erinnerung, Holocaust-Gedenken im Zeitalter der Dekolonisierung. Jana König und Felix Axter haben das ermöglicht und sie haben der deutschen Ausgabe ein Interview mit dem Autor vorangestellt und haben das Buch auch mit einem Nachwort versehen. Und ja, die deutsche Übersetzung hat in den letzten Monaten schon für viel Wirbel gesorgt, vor allem in den Feuilletons der großen Tages- und Wochenzeitungen, aber auch in einigen Online-Veranstaltungen. Und es, ja, einerseits wurde es begeistert aufgenommen und andererseits gab es einige kritische Stimmen. In der Kritik ging es unter anderem um die Frage, ob der Ansatz der multidirektionalen Erinnerung nicht Gefahr laufe, das Gedenken an die Shoah in Deutschland zurückzudrängen, unsichtbarer zu machen, schlimmstenfalls eben zu relativieren. Und ob der Ansatz damit zusammenhängt, eben die Singularität des Holocaust in Frage stellen würde, dadurch, dass vorschnell Gleiches gesehen würde, wo man Unterschiede betonen müsste. Also etwa, wenn der deutsche Kolonialismus und der Mord an den europäischen Juden und Jüdinnen als Genozide beschrieben werden, ohne die Spezifik des Letzteren hervorzuheben. Die Debatte lief bisher recht konfrontativ, sehr polemisch, und es gab wenig Foren für einen Austausch. Und wir hoffen heute, so ein Forum zu schaffen und der Begeisterung wie auch der Kritik gemeinsam mit Michael Rosberg im Gespräch nachzugehen.
Genau, und Michaels Theorien und Reflexionen zu erinnerungspolitischen Praktiken waren auch Grundlage des Sammelbands Erinnern Stören, der Mauerfall aus migrantischer und jüdischer Perspektive, den Lydia Lierke und ich im vergangenen Oktober im Verbrecherverlag herausgegeben haben. Ausgangslage, sich aus unterschiedlichen und unsichtbar gemachten Perspektiven die deutsche Vereinigung anzuschauen, war Michaels These, dass sich die kollektiven Erinnerungen an verschiedenen Geschichten im Dialog miteinander entwickeln und dass der Dialog und die Spannung etwas Produktives sind. Die knapp 20 Autoren und Autorinnen in diesem Band, unter ihnen auch Felix und Jana, die ja auch schon, wie wir eben gehört haben, bei Michaels Übersetzung eine wichtige Rolle gespielt haben, die Autorinnen liefern entsprechend ganz unterschiedliche Perspektiven auf migrantische Kämpfe im geteilten Deutschland, über die Gewalt und Ausgrenzungserfahrung im nationalen Taumel der sogenannten Wiedervereinigung und die nachfolgenden Auseinandersetzungen um eine postmigrantische solidarische Gesellschaft, die bis heute anhalten. Erinnern Stören zeigt darin, dass lebendige Zeugnisse von differenten Communities, verschiedenen Generationen, biografische Erfahrungen aus Ost und West und aus mehreren Jahrzehnten nicht nur von Exklusion und Verfolgung, sondern auch von den eigenen Kämpfen um Anerkennung, Lebensweisen und Geschichten dem Vergessenmachen entrissen werden müssen und neue gemeinsame Sprechorte geschaffen werden können. Aus dieser Vielstimmigkeit und dem vielfältigen situierten Wissen von Migranten und Migrantinnen, Vertragsarbeiterinnen, Juden und Jüdinnen und Roma, Sinti und schwarzen Deutschen und Geflüchteten entstand eine bis dahin verdrängte Erzählung zur Geschichte dieses Landes. Und auch darum, um das Potenzial von multidirektionalen Erinnern für den hiesigen Kontext, soll es im heutigen Gespräch mit Michael gehen. And now, finally, we switch into English. Maybe we can start by explaining to those listeners who haven't heard about your book yet, what is the idea behind the concept and what do you actually mean by multidirectional memory?
Sure, thanks. Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be part of this discussion, and I appreciate your also allowing us to speak in English, which definitely is, at least at the moment, easier for me. Hopefully next time in Berlin, we can do this live and in German. I think, too, you know, the first thing I have to say is that the book Multidirectional Memory, even though it's just appeared in German, of course, goes back a long way. And I started working on it indeed about 20 years ago. And it was directly after I published my first book, Traumatic Realism, which was a revision of my dissertation. And that book really focused specifically on the Holocaust, and in particular, the representation of the Holocaust in testimony, in philosophical discourse, in popular culture. And at the same time, I was interested in providing a framework that might apply more generally to different traumatic histories. So even though it was very much focused on the Holocaust, there was a kind of implicit comparative element to it, or at least I hoped it would be perceived that way. And when I finished that book, I had in mind a project that I thought at that time was going to be something about Blacks and Jews, which was sort of a big topic in the US at that time. And I wanted to try to give it a more transnational spin. A lot of the discourses were really limited to the US, but it seemed to me that it really was a question, the relationship between Black and Jewish cultures, that precisely was diasporic and therefore transnational in scope. And as I started to think about that and to think more about that that topic, I started to realize, of course, the importance of memory as a central category that links in some way Black cultures and Jewish cultures, right? Both are, and this is a broad generalization, but I think nonetheless true, these are traditions, cultures, sometimes overlapping, in which the question of memory is very central. And as I started to think more about memory at that time, I realized that there was a kind of consensus about how memory worked, and in particular, how Holocaust memory worked. And the more I thought about it, the more I felt that this consensus had serious shortcomings and serious problems. And the idea was, and I think it was very prominent then, and I think it's still prominent now, and I think it in fact does mark the German debate that we can talk more about later very clearly. And it was the idea from both sides, so to speak, that Holocaust memory was always either threatened or threatening in a certain sense. In other words, threatened by the presence or the potential presence of memories of other traumatic histories. And then for those who were trying to articulate those other traumatic histories, say the histories of the Black diaspora, histories of colonialism, the Holocaust memory appeared as threatening, as in some sense preventing their articulation in public. And so what I found was there was a kind of conflict over memory taking place, often described as a competition of victims, but I actually use the term competitive memory. And I think I'd want to stick with that for the moment, because I think the question of whether this is really, strictly speaking, a competition of victims is one that we might want to, in fact, interrogate. But certainly there was a kind of conflict over memories and memories of trauma and victimization, to be sure. And what I found was that on both sides of this conflict, if you can speak of it in a somewhat simplistic way, there was a shared understanding of memory as following the logic of what I came to call the zero-sum game. In other words, that if you had memory of the Holocaust, that meant you could not at the same time have a prominent memory of, let's say, slavery or colonialism. And this was shared both by people who were concerned about Holocaust memory and preserving its centrality, and those who were trying to promote, as it were, other memory traditions and bring them into the conversation. And so I did, in fact, as Zina, I think, kind of suggested in her opening remarks, try to find a way out of this deadlock, try to break through this conflict. And it seemed to me that the way to do that was by going back to the fundamental question of how memory works, especially how memory works in public. And what I came to realize and what I came to argue in multidirectional memory is that, in fact, especially public memory, collective cultural memories, do not, I believe, obey the logic of the zero-sum game, whereby the presence of one pushes out the presence of other ones, but rather that in these very conflicts, more memory is produced, not less. You end up with a greater articulation, in fact, a greater diversity of memories. And I'm not saying that this is an automatic process or an inevitable process, and I'm certainly not saying that all histories have been articulated in any kind of adequate way or that they necessarily will be in the future. And yet, at the same time, I think it's sort of empirically true that if you look at the rise of Holocaust memory, let's say during the 90s and the post-Cold War era, what has happened is that we have been led into more and more diverse discussions about different histories, right? That other histories have started, in fact, to become more prominent at the very same moment that the Holocaust has been globalized, right? As so many people have also argued. And so I came to think of the enabling features of memory, of the way that one memory can serve as a kind of inspiration for, provide the language for the articulation of other memories. And I think that's what we've seen with the rise to prominence of discussions of slavery in the US, or more recently, even the Armenian Genocide, which was just recognized, right, by the US state for the first time. I think the discussions that are going on about the history and memory of colonialism in Germany are not in spite of the presence of Holocaust memory in Germany, but in fact are stimulated by them. And I guess I would say, do a kind of thought experiment and ask yourself, if the Holocaust wasn't such a big presence in public cultures, let's say in the US and in Europe, do we really believe that we would instead be talking about other traumatic histories? And to me, the answer is simply no. I think that this, you know, in some ways, this started a kind of process, a dynamic process in which more and more memories started to be articulated, started to come into the public arena. Again, in an imperfect way, in an uneven way, the memory has to be carried by particular groups. It has to be struggled over. It's certainly a field of struggle. But I think that's the dynamic tendency of this process. And so in some ways, that's the most basic understanding that I'd want to communicate about multidirectional memory. It's the idea that memory does not function according to a logic of scarcity, but it's a productive logic. It's a logic that even in conflict and competition and confrontation produces more memory and not less. And that's a structure, for me, that's a structural feature of the way that memory works, but it's one that one also has to pursue historically. And so what I've been talking about the last couple of minutes here is the way that, especially in this most recent period, say from the fall of the Berlin Wall on, the end of the Cold War on, when you've seen a globalization of Holocaust memory, you've also seen increasing discussions of other memory traditions. But in the book, I also, of course, go way back to the early post-war era, before we even had a term, at least in English, for the Holocaust. And I think that was true in a lot of other languages as well. The Holocaust had not yet been articulated as a unique and specific event. And what I try to show is that in those early years, especially say the first 15 or 20 years after the end of the war, what you see is a really dynamic interaction between Holocaust memory, memories of slavery, memories of colonialism, and the ongoing fact of decolonization. And part of my argument is that those other histories also enabled the emergence of the Holocaust, right? So if today it's very easy to see how the Holocaust has enabled the articulation of other memories, or at least that's what I would argue, what I also argue in the book is that the reverse has been true as well, right? That it was people who were responding to colonialism, people who were responding to slavery in the early post-war period, Aimé Césaire, W.E.B. Du Bois, Hannah Arendt, who also were, through engagement with those histories, also starting to bring the Holocaust into visibility at a moment when it really wasn't visible.
Yeah, thanks for that wrap up. I think that's a really good introduction to what you're trying to do and what you're trying to kind of uncover from history, those hidden archives, as those memory archives, as you call them. So I think one sentence that particularly stuck with me and stuck out for me in your book is the sentence, memories are not owned by groups, nor are groups owned by memory. And I think that sentence speaks to a common trend, or rather against the common trend, of thinking in fixed collectives. Whether they are national or whether they're racial. And ironically, I mean, this is a trend that comes, I mean, most certainly from the right and its ethno-pluralism, but it can also be seen in certain leftist forms of identity politics, even though, of course, the motivation is a different one. And I wonder, though, if memories are not owned by groups, who should remember? In other ways, isn't it necessary that we pick some kind of priorities? Be it that, you know, the pain that was passed on through families as victims, or the responsibility that comes with being an ancestor from Nazi perpetrators, or should everyone kind of in a universal fashion, should everyone remember and also commemorate everything? How would you flesh out that link between identity and memory in this general anti-identitarian position that you take in your book?
Yeah, thank you. I think that's a really important question. And it's obviously a tricky question. And I understand the sensitivity of it as well. And it is, but that is that this link and how to think about the link between memory and identity is an important part of the book and an important part of the book's argument. So I talked about the kind of non-zero-sum productive logic of memory. That's one strand of the argument. There's a historical strand which says, let's go back and rethink the way that Holocaust memory emerged and has been transformed and to think about it in these dialogic terms. And then the third strand of my argument is, in some ways, questioning the direct link between memory and identity. So I think when I wrote that sentence, it's of course a sentence I wrote a long time ago, and it's sort of funny to be drawn back to it, though I do think it's an important one. I think what I was first of all getting at, I think the context of that notion that memories are not owned by groups, was partly, again, the refutation of this idea that articulating my memory necessarily excludes the memory of others. And so I think lying behind that notion, again, the kind of zero-sum logic, is a notion of memory as property, right? And so part of what I am doing, indeed, is trying to put some pressure on and to complicate that notion of memory as property. And I think you articulated it, Zina, in very productive terms. You talked about, on the one hand, the particularity of memories, on the other hand, the potential universality of memories. And I think what I'm trying to do in multidirectional memory is precise, or with multidirectional memory, is precisely to trace another possibility that has elements of the particular as well as elements of the universal, without kind of falling too, you know, without going all the way to those extremes of the hyper particular or the abstractly universal, right? It's somewhere in between those two poles that I think the work of multidirectional memory can be productive. And I think this notion that memory is not a personal or a group property, as difficult as that sometimes can be to hear, I mean, I think it's true even for our personal memories. If you think back to and this is something that comes out of memory studies, not has nothing to do with the Holocaust necessarily, but thinking of someone like Maurice Altvachs and others who working in the memory studies tradition, who draw attention to the social nature of memory, right? So that even our earliest memories, those things that we are, you know, are what we remember from our earliest childhood, we're never sure that those are exactly simply pure individual memories, right? We know that, in fact, that they're always influenced by things that other people tell us, right? That our parents, the stories that our parents told us about that era, and we integrate both our own direct memories, if we could talk about that, and this kind of input that we get from the social context in which we have grown up. And I think when we turn to group memories, that's even more true. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that the language in which memory is articulated is a social language. And because it's a social language, that means it's a shared language and a language that goes beyond the boundaries of presumably bounded groups. And so I'm thinking about, for example, lots of different examples come to mind. But let's say, again, now switching to the question of group memory, the importance of the Exodus narrative in Black cultures, right? As a place where, you know, there's a kind of shared vocabulary that you see across Jewish and Black traditions of the importance of Exodus, or the way that various features of Holocaust memorialization have traveled, right, have been redeployed in places like Rwanda or places like Argentina, or to take a non-Holocaust example, something like a form like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa has served as a kind of model for versions of transitional justice that have taken place all over the world. So I guess what I see is that there are various forms and languages of memory that are in fact shared, right? And so that of course there are certain memories that one is more closely tied to and probably should be closely tied to. I'm not trying to deny that. But I think once we start to articulate memories, especially once we start to remember in public, enter into the public sphere, we use languages that are in fact common and shared languages, languages that can't be owned in a certain sense. And I guess the other thing I'd say about that is, you know, when I say memories are not the properties of groups, I'm also not I'm not saying that's these are necessarily good things or necessarily bad things. I'm simply saying this is the way that memory works. So is it good that, for example, you know, the formats of Holocaust memory are exported and used in other contexts like Rwanda? No, I'm not sure that's a good thing, but it seems to me partly an inevitable thing, right? That this is the way that memory is going to work. The second part of the sentence that you mentioned, right, groups are not owned by memories. That's a slightly different point, I suppose. And that's the one that I'm trying to reconstruct. What did I have in mind exactly when I wrote that? I think what I was trying to say was that, of course, and this is in some ways a really obvious point, there are factors other than memory that constitute group identities, right? That we shouldn't simply say that everything that we know about a group can be found in its memories. There are socioeconomic factors, there are geopolitical positions that we all occupy that play important roles, as well as questions of remembrance. And I think this partly comes out of what was a pretty broad critique in the 90s of Holocaust memory in the US context, where there was the idea that I was somewhat sympathetic with, and this wasn't the direct inspiration for multidirectional memory, but it was something I was thinking about already when I was working on my dissertation on traumatic realism. The notion that Jewish identity in the US, at least, had kind of been reduced to Holocaust memory, right? And other elements of Jewish culture, like religion, you know, other histories, other stories, were kind of being pushed aside, and how the Holocaust had become, maybe sometimes along with Israel, had become the centers of Jewish identity. And it was a very reductive notion of what a collective group identity could or should be. And so I think that's partly what I had in mind as well. A little bit pushing back against the overinflation of particular memories of trauma as defining different group identities, starting with the Jewish one, but I think one could probably talk about that in other contexts as well. So I wouldn't say I'm anti-identity politics, because I think that discourse has so much been taken over by the right, at least in my current sense of where things stand, even though the right has its own very obvious forms of identity politics. But I'm certainly suspicious of claims to essential identity. And I do believe that identities are dynamic and changing, and it's particularly in situations of political struggle, I think, you know, we want identities to be mobile. We want them to be dynamic. We want them to change by virtue of the kinds of alliances and solidarities that are constructed in any political process. So I think identity is important, but it's the essentialized, rigidified form of identity that I think my theory and in general, the way I think about things is set against.
Yeah, I want to stay on this argument and give an example from the German context. The anti-racist work of the last 8 years within Germany, the People's Tribunal regarding the NSU complex, we talked a lot about the term situated knowledge. Can this concept maybe help for the question of the two axes you're talking about on multidirectional memory, since the situated knowledge always refers to a history of oppression and experienced racism in this case, but also to the experience of collective and powerful struggle against it. And in the solidarity work, this situated knowledge serves as a situated universalism for justice and democratization, but in the same time, it can also serve for a situated identity in competition to each other. So the collective knowledge that emerge out of memories can have opposite political implications. And I want to ask you, because in the preface of your book, in the interview with Felix and Jana, you talk about the importance of the political effect of memory or memory politics. And can you elaborate a little bit on this term of the political effect?
Sure, yeah, there's a lot there in that question. I mean, I like this notion of situated knowledge, and I do find it useful. And I think it's a way of marking specificity, again, without essentializing it, right? So we're talking about social positions and social positioning, and the way that we are all created by various histories and the various structures that we live within. So of course we're positioned differently, and I think that does give us different access to knowledge and different access to history. But again, it's not essential and unchanging, and I suppose part of the implication of what you're saying is it doesn't always lead in the right direction, right? It can produce conflicts as well. I think your question about what I call these different axes of multidirectional memory was an attempt that I made after I finished writing the book to add more nuance to the model, I suppose, of multidirectional memory. A book is also a form of situated knowledge, I suppose, and I was responding to a very specific context. It's not our context today. It's not your context necessarily in Germany. I think that theories can travel. They should travel. I certainly want them to travel, but they emerge from particular places, and so one has to take that into account. In any case, so what I was doing in the book was I really felt it was important to offer a strong counter narrative to this idea of competitive memory, or even the competition of victims that was very prominent back then. So I absolutely and very deliberately put an emphasis in the book on the construction of what we might call, again, positive forms of multidirectional memory, right? Forms of multidirectional memory that for the most part led in the direction of new forms of solidarity across group identities. Now, it's not that simple in the book already. There are various examples where I feel like, the intellectuals or artists I'm talking about don't necessarily fulfill the ideal version of multidirectional memory that I might have. I think I'm pretty upfront about that. Hannah Arendt, for example, though she's one of the very first to make some of these connections between imperialism and what she called at that time totalitarianism, though I think she really is talking about National Socialism for the most part, I think she makes some really important historical conceptual links, but at the same time, you see traces of colonial ideas of race that are also very fundamental to her thinking and that are very troubling. Or on the other hand, someone like Aimé Césaire, coming out of an anti-colonial context, again, making very provocative and I think interesting connections between the history of colonialism and Nazi genocide, but doing it in such a way that he sort of collapses the differences between different forms of violence. And I also find that somewhat troubling, right? And I guess my perspective on both of them, just to use them as examples, is we don't throw out their insights just because we've located some points of blindness, right? We all have blindness as well as insight. I think we can still learn from them and take things from them, even as we're critical, right? And I think that's how we work as intellectuals, or how we should work as intellectuals. I think sometimes that drops out of some of these debates. But nevertheless, it's true that overall in the book, I was looking for examples that one could hold up as positive examples of cross-identitarian multidirectionality. And people were asking me as I was presenting parts of the book, right before it was being published already, but how do you differentiate between different versions of multidirectional memory? Is multidirectional memory always a good thing? So after I finished the book, one of the very first things I wrote was an attempt to think through that question very precisely. And I took what I thought was, for me at least, the hardest example I could find, which was the rather ubiquitous comparisons that always come up between the Holocaust and the Israeli occupation of Palestine, right? And these comparisons, these come up on all sides of that conflict, as I think everybody is familiar with. And I thought, okay, if I'm going to try to work this out, this is a good starting place, because it's so difficult and because it's so charged. And it was difficult for me. It was really hard to write. And I had a lot of different, political, personal issues that I was trying to work through. But one of the things that I came to see was that in the book, I had primarily worked with a distinction between articulations of multidirectional memory that collapse different histories together, like the Césaire example would be one that I just gave, and then versions of multidirectional memory in which the different histories are preserved in their differentiated status. So I was working with a kind of a single axis there that went between equation and differentiation of different histories. And that's how I made some of the distinctions in the book. But I realized that more needed to be said, and that in fact, you couldn't simply kind of wish away competition, right, in considering these different multidirectional forms of memory, but you had to factor it back in. So I decided that, you know, we needed another axis to think about comparison on, right? On the one hand, what I called the axis of, or think about multidirectional memory on. On the one hand, the axis of comparison between equation and differentiation. On the other hand, an axis of what I called political affect, to go back to your question directly, Massimo, which I kind of mapped between competition and solidarity, right? And it seemed to me that this, you know, two-dimensional, I suppose, chart that you could take from juxtaposing these two axes gave you a series of different positions in which to place or to map, as I called it, different forms of multidirectional memory. You could combine competition with a differentiated understanding of histories, or you could combine competition with a version of history that collapsed everything into the same. And similarly, with solidarity, you could create solidarity by identifying different histories with each other. The example of that in my book is someone like the French Jewish writer André Schwarzbart, who I think really actually kind of pushes Jewish and Black histories so that they end up basically in the same place, collapses them into each other. But you could also have forms of solidarity that were based on a kind of differentiated perspective, one in which you were trying to express solidarity between different victim groups, but you didn't feel at the same time that it was necessary, or in any case, you did not collapse their different historical experiences into each other. The kind of, for me, the best example of that in the book is maybe W.E.B. Du Bois, right? And his visit to the Warsaw Ghetto, the ruins of the Warsaw Ghetto after the war, and the way that it transformed his thinking about race and about his own history in a way that did not say, okay, what Blacks and Jews have experienced in modernity is the same. But that doesn't mean that there aren't grounds for commonality and solidarity. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks for elaborating upon that. I think that's also something that in the book that came out after 2019, The Implicated Subject, you speak a little bit about that and you introduce that axis, which I find really helpful. And I think that's something that really, maybe it's a common misunderstanding that I currently observe in some circles as well. I mean, I think one of the circles where your concept is really seen as something that's very helpful is kind of educational settings, memorial sites. So I see a lot of colleagues from that realm who are really enthusiastic about it, and rightfully so. But where also I sometimes have the impression that multidirectional memory is seen as kind of the way out, as something that's exclusively positive. And I think you pointed to the right way that, you know, that there are situations where that is not necessarily the fact. I mean, more recently, I'm also thinking of the current demonstrations by the so-called corona skeptics who run around with a Star of David pinned to their chest, thinking that, you know, their situation is the same of the Jews in the 1930s. Or I'm thinking of the AfD and Götz Kubitschek and other thinkers of the right who want to commemorate the bombing of Dresden the same way that they want to, you know, commemorate Auschwitz. They don't say the Holocaust never happened. They said, yes, but we also need to, you know, we need this to enable our own victimhood. So and against that, I think it's good to point out to these additional factors that you made out. And I think another factor that I would kind of like to introduce is basically that of like actual historical differentiation. I mean, I know that you are on the level of discourse and of memory, but I also think that, I'm not a historian, but I know there's a long tradition of historiography of comparison that actually has criteria wieder vor, what can, you know, what are the grounds for distinguishing and for comparison? And I think that's helpful to introduce these kind of fact-based discussion, even if we are talking about the level of memory.
If I could just jump in. Yeah, I mean, I agree entirely. I do think that's really important. So I think that, you know, in addition to those two axes that I was just describing, this axis of comparison, the axis of political affect, we absolutely have to consider empirical historical questions as well. And it seems to me that, you know, and again, there's always going to be a question of judgment and interpretation, I suppose. But it does seem to me that there are certain forms of comparison that just on an empirical basis, one wants to reject, right? And so it seems to me that there's a difference. And again, this is going to be controversial among some, and I realize that. And you know, these are all questions that require discussion and interpretation. To me, there's a fundamental difference between making a connection, say, again, between the Holocaust and the Israeli occupation on the one hand, and making a connection between the coronavirus and the Holocaust on the other hand, right? And that the first one, the Holocaust-Israeli occupation, it's controversial. There are a lot of ways in which that goes wrong. I'm critical of them in the essay that I wrote about that. But at least we're talking about histories of political violence. And at some, you know, so there's at least some possibility that you can put them in the same frame and then try to adjudicate how and why those things are being compared. It does seem to me that there are other forms of comparison where you just have to stop right at the beginning and say, no, this is simply not a conceivable comparison. There are simply no historical grounds for bringing these different phenomena together. Now, again, you're always going to find people who are going to argue against that on both sides, right? There will be people who say, no, there's no way on historical grounds you could bring together the occupation and the Holocaust. And there are going to be people who say, but yes, there are some similarities. I can't imagine what they are between, you know, Corona, Masnamen, and, you know, genocidal practices on the other hand. So you're going to find people who will make all of these different kinds of arguments, but I think that there's at least, you know, one can try to establish, okay, what are the grounds for acceptable and unacceptable comparisons, I suppose, and that is going to have a historical dimension, empirical dimension, as you just said, Zina, as well as these questions of affect, as well as these questions of the mode of comparison, I suppose, is the other thing that I would call that.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the challenges in the years to come when also working with your concept. And I also wondered, you said before, you know, a book is also something situated. It came out of a specific time and place, and you elaborated upon what time and place that was for you. And of course, that place is also the United States. You live in right there. And that, of course, has a particular history regarding the commemoration of the Holocaust and, for example, the commemoration of slavery. And in the U.S., I mean, while it took, you know, it took a long time also there for Holocaust memory to be embedded in a wider culture, but it was yet somehow faster and, you know, easier in a way to remember the Holocaust than slavery. I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, for example, the establishment of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in 1993 on the Washington Mall, and it was until 2016 that the Museum of African American History and Culture, which also speaks about slavery, was established there. So, you know, the examples from your book, what I'm trying to say is from the U.S., they're from France, they're not necessarily from Germany. And I'm curious, you know, what in your opinion, what does it mean to read multidirectionally memory in Germany? I mean, what I mean is in a post-National Socialist country where it was, you know, a hard struggle by Jewish survivors, by Jewish communities, and by non-Jewish leftist supporters to establish a kind of memorial culture towards the Holocaust. And so, you know, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to give some of your critics the benefit of the doubt in the way that I think it's legitimate to pose the question, is there a danger involved in a danger that multidirectional memory can lead to a marginalization of Holocaust memory? I mean, is there a danger that we end up with undifferentiated comparisons where, you know, it's one evil among many? Or, you know, what needs to happen for this to be prevented? Or would you say multi-directional memory is kind of the only way, or one of the ways to actually make Holocaust memory relevant for the present? And, you know, I'm also asking that in a situation where it might seem that Holocaust memory is firmly established in Germany, but we also see this rollback, we see this backlash from the right, from the AfD and others. So, you know, we notice that now no memory culture seems to ever be established, firmly established, but it needs to be. It is a constant struggle. So, yeah, what do you think?
Yeah,
it was thanks. A bunch of questions. No, I mean, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's also a really important question. It's a question that is fascinating to me. That means that, you know, it's important to me. That I also, I'm speaking from outside, so I kind of want to hear what you guys think too. You know, I'd love to hear more from you about those questions as well. I mean, strangely enough, I mean, some of multidirectional memory was actually written in Germany, even though it was not written about Germany. I remember specifically writing working on the chapter on Hannah Arendt while I was visiting one summer at the Simon Dubnow Institute in Leipzig. And I presented some of my work there. So some of it was written in Germany, but it's really true that I wasn't, when I was working on it, thinking much about the German context. And it was really only after finishing the book that I started to think more about Holocaust memory in Germany. And I'd already been spending a fair amount of time in Germany in the years before that, but I think it's really especially from, the longest stretches I've spent in Germany came, you know, just after I'd finished the book and then up to a few years ago. What can I say? I do think that these different national contexts are different. Of course, I think you have to work out these questions on the particular terrain in which you're situated. And so I'm not calling for the importation of anything anywhere, you know, just as such. But I do think and I do hope that it can be useful or at least productive to think through some of the questions that are at the core of my book in and for the German context. And I guess for me, what I started to become interested in as I spent more time in Germany and started to think more about these questions in a German context was precisely the post-migrant context of Germany, right? And that's where I started also to develop a certain skepticism about the dominant Holocaust culture in Germany. And this goes back to, I think it was really the year 2008, 2009 that I spent in Berlin and just started to get a sense that, and until then, I think I'd been, I mean, and of course, in many ways still am very impressed by the accomplishments of German Holocaust memory culture. I mean, you know, any criticism that I make should be understood against the backdrop of the fact that I think the situation in the US is, you know, far worse in lots of ways. And that's true almost everywhere else in the world too. So I think everybody recognizes that there have been things that have been accomplished in Germany, but I started to become skeptical about those again around 2008, 2009, and that skepticism continues up to this day, because it seemed to me that Holocaust memory was being used in a kind of disciplinary fashion in regards to migrants, post-migrants, and minorities in Germany, where there was a kind of impossible demand being put on people marked as migrant or racialized migrants in any case. On the one hand, in order to be German, you must remember the Holocaust. On the other hand, people being told again and again, this is not your history, you know, don't mix yourself into this history. And this was kind of what Yasemin Yildiz and I called in an article from about 10 years ago, the migrant double bind. That, you know, that there were these conflicting demands being put on migrants. And it did seem to me that there was a kind of displacement that was happening. And that I think, again, still to some extent is happening, where certain, you know, disturbing features of society like anti-Semitism are being kind of pushed onto people who are themselves in racialized, minoritized positions. It doesn't mean that the anti-Semitism couldn't possibly exist in migrant milieus. Of course, I know that it does, but it seemed to me that the way the discourse was working was a kind of disciplinary fashion. Both memory of the Holocaust and accusations of anti-Semitism were being used in those particular ways. So that's one thing that I'd want to say. It also seems to me that when you know, the other side of what we called the migrant double bind was what we called the German paradox. And that was the note, and I think, again, this is very prominent. I think this is very important to think about. And this was the notion, and we're not the only ones to, Yasmin Yildiz and I, they're not the only ones who have remarked on this, but there's an extent to which Holocaust memory in Germany came to be a way of reproducing and reconfirming a certain ethnic German subject. Right, that who is a German? The German is the one who traces back their history to the Second World War and the crimes of the Nazis. And by taking responsibility for that, then ironically, you're also reconfirming a kind of ethnic German identity. And that's what leads ultimately to this kind of disciplining and marginalization of racialized minorities in the society. And yet, as you guys, of course, know well and work on in your own work, Germany is a very diverse country, right? And has been always and is only becoming increasingly more so. And so if you start from a post-migrant perspective, I think what you see is you need a more heterogeneous historical narrative. For people to be able to identify with, I suppose, for people to want to join in. And I think that's where it does get complicated, I know, because I understand the anxiety about relativization, minimization of the Holocaust. I certainly understand the threats that are coming from the right, the kind of minimization that you see from the AfD and others. So I think those are very real. But I think the problem is still, okay, but what kind of memory culture can we have in a post-migrant society, in a Gesellschaft der vielen, right, as you call it? And here I hope that a kind of multidirectional perspective can be productive. And I hope that it can be productive because I think it offers at least the possibility, and again, as we've talked about, it doesn't always work out this way in practice, it offers the possibility for what I call a differentiated solidarity, right? It offers a possibility for holding on to the specificity of different histories, including, of course, especially the history of the Holocaust, but also for admitting that there are multiple histories that are at stake for Germans of all sorts, right? With and without migration background, with and without Nazi background, however you want to call it, right? There's really a multiplicity of relevant and important histories. And bringing in ones alongside the Holocaust does not have to mean that we are, you know, minimizing, relativizing, or otherwise downgrading the importance of the Holocaust, that one should be able to recognize German responsibility for that genocide. In fact, those genocides, the other aspects of Nazi policy that also, or Nazi actions that also seem to get less attention, the genocide on the Roma and Sinti, the killing of people considered disabled, right? Not to mention the millions of Poles and Russians who were killed in the war, civilians and others, right? There's a whole plethora of victim groups who one would want to remember and establish responsibility for. And then other histories as well, the history of colonialism, et cetera, et cetera. And then of course, migrants who themselves come with or are in some ways connected to histories that seem to go beyond the German, but yet are now part of German society, right? The Armenian genocide, I mean, there are certainly connections already with Germany itself, but you also have a lot of people with very differentiated connections to the Armenian genocide over the course of generations. And that has to be part of the discussion, right? You can't eliminate that. And I don't think it has to be a hierarchy, and I don't think it has to be a competition, even if we do need to be sensitive to preserving specificity and even singularity, right, for different histories. That's at least the beginning of an answer.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, and I think one could also ask, you know, in order to keep Holocaust memory alive, don't we have to make it relevant to those who bring different histories with them? And, you know, one could say, well, the Holocaust is a universal event, it's relevant for everyone, but also the way it was often taught and commemorized here, it was and is a very German history. And I know, you know, from teachers and I know from educators in kind of memorial sites and so on, that, well, if they have young people there, then more than half of these have a so-called migration background, this very German word, and so we, you know, they already 10, well, let's say 15 years ago, those educational workers in concentration camp memorial sites and so on realized that we need different methodologies than we did than we had 20, 30 years ago if we want to teach about this event and teach it to those who are here in these very post-migrant settings. So, yeah, I think that...
And I think that's, true everywhere. I mean, and so just to stick with the Holocaust specifically, or the Second World War and the Nazi period specifically for a moment, I mean, we're at a key moment, right? We're in a transitional moment generationally, where the memory is going to be passing from, you know, what again in memory studies we call communicative memory to cultural memory, right? From transgenerational family memory, small group memories, to things that have to be, you know, have to be textualized and remembered via monuments and memorials and school books and films and culture in general. So we're in a kind of transitional moment. And I think in that moment, it's really important, yeah, to start to try to think in new ways about memory and how it's transmitted and how we want to preserve it. And in some ways, I think in that moment, the migrant figure becomes a kind of model for what memory could or should be. Precisely, how are we going to remember when we don't have a direct personal connection, right? When those family connections start over the course of generations really to thin out, which is just an inevitability, I think. So we need to think about other subjects of memory, other positions from which to remember, which are not going to be so ethnically, familially, or communicatively loaded, but in fact are going to come from broader cultural exchanges. And so, yeah, I think we need to be creative at this moment. And that's true not just in Germany, that's certainly true in the US too. You know, there are always these, these studies again and again. Kids don't know what Auschwitz is. Kids don't know how many Jews were killed in the Holocaust, et cetera, et cetera. I don't necessarily see that among my own students, but I'm sure these are real phenomena. But if we want them to know those things, we need to think about the modes of transmission. And I guess I feel that an overly dogmatic or rigidified memory culture is not going to succeed in creating those new forms of identification and connection across generations, especially in heterogeneous, multicultural contexts. We need to open things up. We need to be open to possibilities for connections across histories. And I think a little more openness to the potential of comparison and connection in the German context is worth the risk. You know, and I see the risk, but I think we need a little more openness, so that people care enough, you know, that these matters are still central to them and that they can be transmitted further.
Yeah, totally. And coming to an end, I wonder also if solidarity can only emerge out of a shared notion of difference, and that would be the opposite of what we talked earlier about the Corona demonstration. Comes to mind this young woman on the demonstration, Jana from Kassel. She said, "I feel like Sophie Scholl." So she said she claims the sameness, yeah. And I want to give a different example, and maybe a last example for our discussion. An example I want to discuss with you, and I always I mention very often Also in the Manipod episodes, because it's so crucial to me. In 2017, during the so-called Mölln speech in exile, die Möllner Rede im Exil, I don't know if you're familiar with that, which is performed by the Aslan family, former immigrant family from Turkey, who faced an arsonal attack against their house in Mölln in 1992, during which two young girls and their grandmother were killed. And Ibrahim Aslan, who survived the fire as a 9-year-old boy, and Esther Bejerano, who survived Auschwitz as a young girl, went on stage and placed their stories next to each other. Two children whose family were killed by Nazis, but by no means calling the wave of racism in the early 90s or the industrial organized genocide against Jews in Nazi Germany the same. And this strikes me every time I look at it again. And just 1 week ago, this year's Mölln speech in exile, performed by Nevros Duman, a former refugee and a main figure in the Solidarity Network in Hanau with friends and families of the victims of the Nazi terrorist attack from last year. And Naomi Henkel-Gümbel, a survivor of the anti-Semitic terrorist attack against the synagogue in Halle in October 2019, again told their stories to each other, next to each other, to the public. And within politics of solidarity organized by the victims of racism and anti-Semitism, multidirectionality, it seems to me, is not a zero game, as you say, but expands the space for empathy and politics of remembrance. And I want to ask you, what is your... What do you think about that? I mean, this is like how in recent solidarity work victims deal with the question of difference and talking together in a common space, in a common way.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm very moved by those examples. And, you know, a lot of what I've worked on since finishing multidirectional memory, as well as, I suppose, in multidirectional memory, has to do with questions of solidarity, you know, and so, I'm not here to prescribe the way that solidarity should be expressed. I think it's expressed in different forms, obviously, but I am particularly interested in those forms that go beyond, I guess, the expected, or go beyond the kind of, again, organic, quote unquote, organic links within a group that you might expect to find that, right? If we are attacked as Jews, then we respond as Jews. And of course, one does do that and one should do that. I'm not saying one shouldn't do that. But I'm also interested, especially because I think they're also necessary to a greater political struggle, in those forms of solidarity that go beyond those kind of identitarian or simply or uniquely identitarian logics and open up into this field, again, of what I call a kind of differentiated solidarity, where we can recognize that we have different histories, we have different experiences, but there are still grounds for commonality. There's still grounds for struggling together, for remembering together, for being together more generally. And Esther Bejarano and her work with Microphone Mafia is actually something that's really inspired me and that I write about, that we write about in this book that I'm working on with Yasemin Yildiz about sort of migrant memories, migrant archives of Holocaust remembrance, as we call it. And one of the things we're interested in is these kind of Jewish, non-Jewish, often migrant or even Muslim immigrant forms of collaboration that we find, you know, various examples of in Germany in recent times. And again, I think are very powerful in lots of different ways. You know, when I wrote Multidirectional Memory, I was not trying to, you know, offer any kind of handbook for activism or for cultural production or anything like that. It was a scholarly contribution to thinking about memory in general and Holocaust memory in particular, first and foremost. Even though, of course, some of the people that I talk about in there are in fact activists or political militants, for example, anti-colonial militants during the Algerian War in France, who were very important to me in the writing of that book. But I wasn't trying to write a handbook for activism, but of course I've been happy when I've been approached by, over the years, by artists or activists who have found some of the ideas, inspiring for their own work. And I'm glad about that, and I want it to be. And again, I think it doesn't always necessarily apply, simply one-to-one. You have to recalibrate how these things will work in different contexts, of course, but I'm happy to see that it can be inspiring. And in my more recent book, The Implicated Subject, in some ways I'm dealing there even more directly with questions of activism, not just memory activism, but including memory activism. And indeed, trying to think more about this question of differentiated solidarity and how can people who are situated in different ways in relationship to the racial logics that we all live within, how can they potentially work together? And it's not only, and I'll say that, I'm very inspired and moved by the kinds of examples you mentioned, Massimo, where you have victims, or let's say descendants of victims in some cases, of different histories coming together for a particular cause. I do think that's very powerful and important. What I'm also interested in, though, is how those who are situated in more privileged positions can also come into alliance and in solidarity with those who are victims or descendants of victims. So that, and that's what I mean by this notion of the implicated subject, right? These are people who are enabling or benefiting from histories of violence or racialized histories of violence in particular, who also need to find ways to be in solidarity. And I think it's especially important that solidarity does not pass through simple forms of identification, right? So I've been thinking, like everybody else has, I think in the last year especially, but longer than that, of course, also about Black Lives Matter, right? And what does it mean for a white person like myself to be in solidarity with a movement like that? And I think it's obviously important that we are, but again, I don't think that can pass simply through lines of identification and commonality. Like, yes, I'm Jewish, there's a long history of suffering that Jews have experienced over many years, but I'm white and I'm an American citizen. I'm really in a position of great privilege. And so I can't simply link my history to that of African Americans in this country based on a shared history of suffering, because I do not have the same shared history of suffering. I have to recognize my own position as someone who has in fact benefited from the very racial structures against which groups like Black Lives Matter are struggling. And I think that, I think we all, though, have complicated identities. We're situated in different ways in relationship to different histories. And that's what I try to discuss and theorize in The Implicated Subject. And I think we need to take into account that differentiation and unevenness as we think about solidarity across groups. Because it's that unevenness which is going to, is going to make things more difficult at certain moments. I mean, this is complicated. It's not an easy thing, but I think some kind of self-reflexive recognition of the way we're positioned, at least, and that we don't occupy the same position as others, is an important step, at least, in forging solidarity. The other thing I would say, and this is something I've been thinking a lot about in the last several years, especially, and it's linked to some of the questions you've been asking, Zina, you also, about, let's say, the kind of more troubling forms of multidirectional memory, as well as the kind of rise and mobilization of the right, is in some ways, I think we need to take the far right at its word, right? And what I'm thinking about here is, I'm thinking about Challah. And when you attack a synagogue and then you go shoot up a Duner Imbiss, right, and kill racialized minorities, or when you march to preserve a Confederate monument in Charlottesville and you also fly Nazi flags and chant "Jews will not replace us," right, you are... The right is bringing together in a multidirectional way these different histories of racism and anti-Semitism, of genocide and racial violence. My response to that is we have to take that seriously. We can't just say, but wait a minute, they're relativizing the Holocaust. That's not the, you know, to me, that's not the right response. For me, the right response is, yeah, these people are racist and anti-Semitic. That doesn't mean racism and anti-Semitism are the same. But if we want to confront the far right, we have to confront both of those features. And we have to do that in some way together, right? Both in terms of coalitions, but also theoretically, right? We have to try to understand what it is that's made it possible for the Confederate flag and the Nazi flag to fly next to each other, or for someone to go from a synagogue to an imbiss like that. It doesn't mean we don't want to differentiate, but we need to think relationally, and we need to think comparatively, and we need to act, I think, relationally and comparatively and in solidarity across different kinds of groups. So these histories, I guess for me, the lesson of the last several years is these histories really are very entangled, and they're entangled today in the present as they were in the past. And we need to take that entanglement seriously, not to collapse everything into one pot, as people sometimes think that I'm doing. It's not what I'm doing, but to think about, you know, think about the cross currents, think about the relationality, think about the connections.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. And it's also one that I remember Sabrina Slipchenko, one of the Halle survivors, actually made in an event that Rosa Luxemburg Stiftung did, that the far right seems to be two steps ahead of us in already seeing these solidarities where sometimes we lag behind and only seeing competition. And I mean, I'm also thinking about the situation in the United States where you had these big civil rights actors like the Anti-Defamation League and the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored Peoples, coming back together and saying, you know, this, I remember in 2017 or so, they gave a joint statement saying enough is enough. We need to forge these links against these links between black and Jewish communities against a president that, you know, has both these groups as an enemy, or at least supports both these ideologies, and against far right movements that know very well, like you just said, who the enemy is. So, you know, we better damn well get our act together and think again what solidarity could look like. And like you said, I totally agree that this needs to be done in some form that goes beyond goes beyond personal identity. That's the challenge that lies ahead. Thanks for giving us some inspiration to think this through. And I think we raised some of the questions that we all need to kind of continue asking, and some of the criticism and the problematic aspects that we need to kind of discuss with each other.
I hope we continue our discussion face to face in Berlin maybe this year. That would be great. Thank you very much from my side also for the fascinating discussion and your insights and arguments. I think they're really needed and very helpful for the discussion in Germany.
Thank you both. This has been, I think, very productive, and it's great to speak with you. And I look forward also to continuing the conversation.
All right. Thanks, Michael.
Bye. Take care.
Bye. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Good to talk to you guys. Bye.
Ihr hörtet in Manyport Nummer 9 mit Michael Rothbeck und Sina Arnold zu dem Thema multidirektionale Erinnerungen in der postmigrantischen Gesellschaft.